How do we heal the modern epidemic of loneliness? There may be no simple solution, but maybe what we need is some ancient wisdom. That's what Sharon Brous offers in her new book, The Amen Effect: Ancient Wisdom to Mend Our Broken Hearts and World. Sharon is an influential speaker and the co-founder and senior rabbi of Ikar, a Jewish congregation in Los Angeles. Our curator Dan Pink says her book is a powerful call for each of us to show up for others, see them fully, and hold them close. Here's Sharon with five of her big ideas.
I'm Sharon Brous, author of The Amen Effect: Ancient Wisdom to Mend Our Broken Hearts and World, and senior and founding rabbi of Ikar. I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from my book. Insight number one: loneliness and social alienation pose a grave threat to our health, safety, and well-being. We are living through an era marked by loneliness, social alienation, and isolation, a condition only exacerbated by COVID. And it's breaking our spirits, it is hurting our bodies, and it is threatening our democracy. Loneliness is more an inner state than an external reality. It's about feeling alone, not necessarily about being alone. It impacts all of us, single and partnered, young and old, urban, suburban, rural. Loneliness is vastly prevalent, and it's so dangerous that it's now considered a public health crisis, both in the United States and around the world, a crisis that has reached epidemic proportions. Loneliness is hurting our spirits. It's leading us to experience a profound sense of disconnection, despondency, and despair. It's hurting our bodies. Acute loneliness has the physical impact on the body of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And it's threatening our democracies. As Hannah Arendt, the great 20th century philosopher, argued, widespread social alienation is a precondition for the flourishing of violent political extremism. Terror, she wrote, can rule absolutely only over men who are isolated against each other. Therefore, one of the primary concerns of all tyrannical governments is to bring this isolation about. Isolation may be the beginning of terror. It certainly is its most fertile ground. It always is its result. For Arendt, isolation is impotence. The more limited our meaningful contact with one another, the more we lack the ability to act together toward the common good, let alone to respond effectively to the great dangers we face. Alone and apart, we are powerless. It is a matter of the greatest urgency that we address this crisis, our instincts to retreat from one another, with a reinvigorated commitment to step toward one another instead. Insight number two: we are biologically, psychologically, and spiritually hardwired for connection and belonging, so err on the side of presence. My grandma Millie had a rule: you show up for the celebration. She framed her rule like this: if, God forbid, you would fly in for the funeral, you better find a way to make it there for the wedding. My grandma lived to 98 and my grandfather to 90, and I attribute their longevity to the fact that they went dancing every night, they never turned down a Doers on the Rocks before dinner, and they embodied to the very end this rule. They showed up. Life is precarious, but you're alive, so show up in body and spirit. Now, there's an assumption that's embedded in my grandma's rule. You'll show up for the celebration because you'd obviously be there for the heartache. But that, I have learned, is not something to be taken for granted either. Some years ago, my mentor lost his mother. Now, one of his superpowers is that everyone who's ever met him feels that they're his closest friend. So when my mentor's mother died, I imagined him suffocating under the weight of 1,000 well-intentioned best friends, overwhelming him with lasagna and lingering hugs. I wrote a sweet letter and put it in the mail. I didn't fly in for the funeral, and to my shame, I didn't even pick up the phone to check on him. When I saw him a few months later, he castigated me. "I don't want excuses," he said. "I needed you and you weren't there. Next time, show up." It was at this point that I had to amend my grandma's rule. You show up for the celebration and you also show up for the funeral. You err on the side of presence. Biologists, neurologists, psychologists, and clergy all attest to the same fundamental truth. Human beings need connection. It's connection that gives our lives meaning and purpose. From a spiritual standpoint, we are meant to live dialogically. The gift that God gave humanity from the start, according to the Hebrew Bible, was the gift of one another. We have a profound human need to be seen as we truly are, which makes social connection not a luxury, but a necessity. Relationships are simply core to our being. It's not good for a person to be fundamentally alone. Seeing one another in celebration, sorrow, and solidarity, showing up for each other in the most challenging moments and the moments in between, is essential to our well-being. There are so many reasons why we pull away from each other. There are so many barriers to honest, heartfelt presence and condition, chief among them the faulty notion that our work, especially in the most painful moments, is not just to be present with each other, but to fix one another. Instead, as one of my dear congregants, a bereaved father, shared with me after his son's tragic death, what people need in anguish more than anything else is withness. We don't need people to fix us, he told me. We need to not be abandoned. We need people to be willing to sit with us in the pain. Our task as friends and community is not to repair each other's broken hearts, to heal or to save or to distract or to cheer each other up. We really just need to show up, to be present, to engage in the work of sacred accompaniment. Insight number three. Our hearts are capacious enough to hold sorrow and celebration, joy and pain. Our communities must be too. Several years ago, one of the families in our community went away for a short end of summer vacation, and their beautiful little boy, Giddy, was killed in a terrible boating accident. It was just days before his fifth birthday. This was a child who introduced himself to strangers in line at the ice cream shop and greeted every teacher by name as he galloped into school each morning, exuberant. His death made a mockery of the world. The death of a child turns upside down the normal order of things. This is a disturbance so profound that it inverts all logic and reasoning, leaving only chaos in its wake. The death of this child was heartbreaking and terrifying and destabilizing. It was a blunt force confrontation with the unavoidable truth of our vulnerability. A terrible, reverberative trauma tore through our community. That first night after Giddy's funeral, his family told me that they were planning on coming to Shabbat services so that they could say the mourner's prayer. So we'll do what we do, I thought. We'll make space to hold the grief. The problem was that Shabbat we were planning to celebrate the bar mitzvah of a wondrous child in our community. This boy embraced and delighted in every moment of his preparation and learning, and he deserved a wholehearted celebration. We have to remember here that joy, celebration, is a spiritual necessity, and joy is intended not only to be experienced, we have to make time for joy, but also to be shared with others. Sometimes when we experience something wonderful, it doesn't even feel real until we share it with other people. I got into college. The doctor called with a good report. I've been sober a full year. I think I'm falling in love. We have a real biological need to share our joy, and the research shows that sharing our joy may be even more impactful than experiencing it in the first place. We have the natural capacity to be energized and inspired by someone else's dream fulfilled, even when our own hearts are aching. But how? How do we dance and sing in the presence of so much pain? I wondered that Shabbat, how we could bear the weight of so much sorrow and celebration. I wondered if the walls of the room and our hearts would simply collapse. But they did not. We lifted the bar mitzvah boy high in a chair, and we threw candy and we shouted blessings at him, even as the bereaved family stood shattered just a few feet away. We wept and we danced. Rather than mute our joy in the face of profound loss, we must embrace it fully. As human beings, we need not to avoid or minimize or compartmentalize our grief. We must grieve deeply, but with hearts that contain multitudes. And we can and we must celebrate wholeheartedly, though always with deep, humble awareness of how precarious it all is. In this way, we honor the complex beauty of the human condition. We affirm how spacious, capacious, and profoundly interconnected we are. Insight number four. We often find our life's purpose not in searching for it, but in serving others. My friend Erin was a young mother when her life was interrupted by a stage 4 breast cancer diagnosis. Despite her fierce will to live, and despite the unyielding love of her husband, her children, and so many dear friends, the cancer rapidly progressed. In the final moments of her life, Erin spent time at a cancer retreat center where she wrote the following. What is your soul calling you to do? What is the mission, the meaning that only you can fulfill? Where have you hidden away your most profound desires and aspirations? Can you unearth them? Most importantly, how are you actively thwarting their accomplishment? We so assiduously sabotage the very thing that would bring us the most satisfaction. Erin seemed determined to leave us with an enduring message. Our life's work is to discern our core purpose, to hear the call, and then to do everything we can to live into it for whatever time we have. I hear in her words a mysterious, ancient call. Something is being demanded of us. Something is expected of us. Now, identifying and living into that purpose is a spiritual imperative of the highest order. Each of us was brought into this world with some higher purpose. What does this moment demand of me? How am I uniquely able, whether by circumstance or through the cultivation of gifts and abilities, to meet this moment? Our life's work is to hold the spiritual and moral clarity we need to live into our purpose, a purpose unique to each of us and to the time that we live in. So how do we do this? We step into our purpose by refusing to look away from one another. We do this by really seeing each other in our beauty and our brokenness, by turning to one another in sorrow and in celebration and saying, "Tell me your story." We do this by recognizing that we are called to be of service to one another. We know that our emotional health and wellness is enhanced by our presence with one another. Showing up for another person, being of service to another, alters the physical and psychological landscape of our hearts, because tender presence is a direct line to the heart. Our faith traditions bear this out. One Spanish rabbi, writing in the 13th century, explains that one of the most crucial and important things a person is called to do in life is exert himself to the full depths of his soul on behalf of another person. His near contemporary, St. Francis of Assisi, wrote that our highest mission as human beings is to be of service to one another. He wrote, "It would be considered a theft on our part if we didn't give to someone in greater need than we are." These thinkers understood the power and promise of turning to one another in acts of service and love as a way of healing our own broken hearts and one another's, and a way of finding our mission and purpose in this world as we repair our overculture. Insight number five, we are suffering from a massive curiosity deficit. Through reclaiming curiosity and wonder, we rehumanize ourselves and one another. Just as a lonely person can become a sick person in body and spirit, a society of lonely, atomized, socially disconnected people will become a sick society, one susceptible to extremist ideologies and powerless to resist dangerous social and political upheaval. For decades, we have witnessed a mushrooming of social alienation and disconnectedness, and we seem to have reached a crisis point. Nearly a third of Americans today report that they do not know their next-door neighbors, and an astonishing 20% of Americans report that they have no close personal relationships at all. And that number has more than doubled in the past decade. Imagine that. No neighbor to knock on the door just to check in on you when you're ill. No one to process the fear, confusion, or displacement of these uncertain times. No one to help us hold our personal or collective grief. This level of isolation and disconnectedness is not only concerning, it's dangerous. And this crisis of disconnection is exacerbated by another trend of our time, tribalization. Human beings from birth are hardwired for connection, but we are also by nature tribal beings, meaning we instinctively look to build and reinforce those connections with people that we perceive to be like us, whether that means they look like us, talk like us, pray like us, or vote like us. Tribal attachments can be meaningful and beneficial. A sense of belonging can be a source of great strength and purpose. The tribal mindset leads us to fight mightily for those that we see as part of our tribe. But there's also a dangerous side to this instinct. Ironically, the stronger the bonds of connection we have to those inside our group, the weaker the bonds are to those outside our group, leaving us indifferent or even hostile toward people who are not in our tribe. This is the cost to self-segregating in our tribal bubbles, whether organized around race, religion, ethnicity, or ideology. Curiosity is the birthplace of compassion, but the greater the psychological distance between us and the other, the less curious we are about one another. When we don't wonder what the other is thinking or feeling or where the pain comes from, when we don't interrogate our presuppositions, our hearts close to one another. This leaves us less understanding of other perspectives and more entrenched in our own dogmas and narratives. It also leaves us more susceptible to dangerous fringe views. A society devoid of empathy is at great risk of falling into patterns of dehumanization that have throughout history led to the most extreme acts of violence. Extremist movements are already testing the very limits of our democracies, and all indications are that this will only worsen in the days ahead unless we find the appetite for a dramatic course correction. It is precisely now when our instinct is to recoil from one another that the need for an ethos of sensitive, sincere encounter is vital and urgent, not only for us as individuals, not only for our families and for our communities, but for our society. When we turn to one another with open-hearted curiosity, it's often we who benefit. By affirming another person's humanity, we reinvigorate our own. But there are precious moments when the seeds sown in the field of wonder flourish into something unexpected and truly wonderful in the world. This can be the beginning of something new. Deep, open-hearted curiosity can utterly transform our relationships and our society. Human understanding is no substitute for real accountability or for systemic change, but it's also not an impediment to those righteous outcomes. If anything, it may be a prerequisite. Vulnerable, open-hearted engagement is counterinstinctual in our time. And in order to be curious, we must first be safe. But any just society will have to make space for people who see the world in fundamentally different ways, for us to see one another not as enemies, but as fellow human beings, flawed and striving. Wonder and curiosity lead us to sacred encounter. This is not a path toward capitulation, but instead toward sacred recognition of each other's humanity. This may be the best and most enduring way to mend our broken hearts and worlds. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you find the book meaningful.
Thank you, Sharon. That was Sharon Brous with 5 big ideas from The Amen Effect, Ancient Wisdom to Mend Our Broken Hearts and World. You might also like our book bite for How the Talmud Can Change Your Life, Surprisingly Modern Advice from a Very Old Book by Liel Leibovitz. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.